Welcome to another episode of Let's Talk, a podcast where we feature individuals and organizations who are working hard to bring our AAPI and Black communities together. By highlighting their stories, we hope to encourage inclusive, intergenerational, and anti-racist perspectives in all spaces. I'm Stephanie Hong, the Program Manager at the Oakland Asian Cultural Center, and this is Let's Talk. Today, we will hear from Angela Lin and Consuela Hendricks, co-founders of People Matter, a community-based organization based in Chicago. Using their experiences and positionality within Chinatown, they work to address anti-Blackness in the Asian American community and to build relationships between Chinatown's Black and Asian populations. Joining us as facilitator is Pamela Ibanez, OACC's Facilities Coordinator.
All right, so I thought we'd just get started introducing ourselves and talking about your background.
Yeah, so I can start first. My name is Angela Lin. I am co-founder of People Matter along with Consuela, who is here with me. She's also my best friend. I am from the suburbs of Atlanta, but I lived in Shenzhen for 3 or 4 years growing up. And that's where I got my language skills that paved my road to organizing. But I came to Chicago about 10 years ago. And then right after I graduated from college, I fell into this community organizing position in Chicago, Chinatown's really only political organization, advocacy organization. And that's where my Consuela, because she had been a volunteer at the organization since she was like a teenager. And she really had a lot of institutional knowledge that she like shared with me and really taught me a lot about Chinatown, which I think a lot of people find weird. Like people say, like, how did this Black person teach you about your own Chinese history and culture and things like that? I think Consuela was a really big part of my entry into Chinatown and understanding my Chinese identity. I worked on an organizing project, and my very first day was basically on this very racially tense campaign for a high school for Chicago's Chinatown that essentially was going to shut down a majority low-income Black elementary school that was also very high performing. So right on the bat, like my organizing journey was very much racial tensions, deep-rooted racial tensions between Black and Chinese folks on the south side of Chicago. And, Consuela and I, we were such a big part of the Chinatown community, but the Chinatown community had a lot of issues that weren't being addressed, such as anti-Blackness, such as, domestic violence, different things that weren't being addressed. And so that's why we wanted to create an alternative and to create something that would address these things. And that's why, that's how we started People Matter and really started doing a lot of work together, specifically on tackling anti-Blackness and just bridging race relations across like all communities of color on the south side of Chicago to have like a more united front to fight for schools, fight for healthcare, fight for housing, things like that. And I'll pass it to Consuela.
So my name is Consuela Hendricks. I'm co-president of People Matter. I got myself started in the work that we do today back in high school. I've been organizing since I was 16 years old. I was part of this club called Undocumented Unafraid, and I was vice president of that club. We were fundraising for our fellow students, mostly our undocumented students and undocumented peers. In addition to that, I started a club called International Club. This was due to a lot of the gang violence that was happening at my high school, specifically between Black and Brown students. One day, someone told me, hey, Consuela, don't go outside because they're hitting or they're going to probably kill any Black person outside. So I think that you should stay behind. So that sparked me to start trying to do more racial equity work and racial justice work within my school, because it was affecting my real life. But also, I've really felt like we didn't necessarily have to fight as violently. I remember walking outside school that day and seeing puddles of blood on the sidewalk and really being fearful of what really happened and who was actually hurt. So that sparked me to start organizing in my high school around, again, racial justice work and starting these conversations. Of course, it was really difficult to get gang members to come to my club. However, we did start having conversations about race, identity, immigration status, and et cetera. And I was able to work with my school's bilingual program into building that out. And so we just had really deep conversations around identity. One of the people there actually had brought me to Chinatown at that age as well, saying hey, you should do some of this work in Chinatown. So at 16, then I was able to go to Chinatown and I was volunteering at the organization where I met Angela at for about 9 years. And during that 9 year span, I was like helping with voter registration and really building my understanding and connection to the Chinese American community, as well as, you know, just figuring out like what best ways that we could all work together. And that's part of the reason why me and Angela started our organization, because we found that not that many people were talking about these issues, or even the most marginalized communities that are in Chinatown. And so we wanted to break away and like figure out ways that we can start these conversations and start building solidarity amongst Black, Brown, and Chinese, as well as like Asian American individuals in the communities that we serve.
Great. Thank you so much for that background information, Angela and Consuela. I'll just talk briefly about myself and how I found your group. I am the facilities and rentals coordinator. My name is Pamela Ibanez. I've been at OACC since January. I've always been interested in these like intersections of Black and Asian communities and looking at historically how these communities, or when different communities come together, they can create so much more power and change in our lives. So I was really excited to learn about People Matter. And when I was working at the Black Heroes of Chinatown event, when you both came and presented to Willie Davis, it was really an awesome event, and like how the community came together. And it was like from kids to seniors, and just to learn about his impact that Willie Davis has made in our area. It was really exciting. And I thought it was such a great thing to have in our center, and just to highlight like achievements of the Black community, since obviously in Oakland, we're housed with right in downtown, and these communities definitely come together in this area. So so I was really excited to meet that you both were willing to do this interview. So thank you so much. You talked a little bit about how the organization got started, and I was looking at your website and on the About Us page for People Matter. One, Consuela kind of talks about walking through Chinatown and feeling afraid. And I think that is like something that I haven't really heard from a Black person walking through Chinatown, like how they feel. And so that was kind of eye-opening to me. And I guess I'm interested in what your thoughts were in starting this organization together, and like the kind of changes you'd like to see from the work you're doing.
Yeah, definitely. I can answer that first, and then I can pass it to Angela. Yeah, so our thoughts around getting this started was because, like I was saying earlier, like no one was really talking about this, and even connecting it to my own personal experience is that, again, like I was in a lot of spaces where we were talking about activism within Chinese American spaces. We're talking about different things that, you know, the community that we're serving was in need of. And I think that at the same time, what was being ignored was the huge undertone of anti-Blackness, right? So I saw myself even as a child helping out. So what I see as my community is Chinatown, Chicago's Chinatown, right? And being part of that, but yet still feeling like I'm an outsider in the sense of racial background, right? And in some ways, of course, like I would never be Chinese American, of course that, but it was also feeling like I was people putting me in a box of not being a particularly a community member, right? And which sparks a lot of conversations where we end up talking to other like Black American folks, or like Black folks in general, who are feeling the same way, where they are fourth generation Chinatown residents, and they're having these conversations around like, hey, I still don't feel quite accepted into the community, right? Which sparked us to even like started like interviewing people, having these conversations, as well as like doing our work about other folks who may be neglected that share Chinese American or Chinese immigrant identities, who may not also be talked about in our own personal Chinatown.
Definitely. And I mean, I think that what you point to, Pamela, is something that I think a lot of people feel the same, because I mean, oftentimes in Chicago's Chinatown, but from what I understand, many Chinatowns, Black and Asian tensions are very high right now. And so a lot of, you know, Chinatown community members will be very scared of Black people and be like, you know, surveilling them. In our community, we have like the Chinatown Gun Club, like the Chinese Gun Club, the Chinatown Neighborhood Watch, that really like ramped up since 2020 to do a lot of police surveillance of Black folks. And, you know, like lots more violence and violent rhetoric since 2020. And I think, you know, a lot of people, Chinese people, are scared of Black people, but people don't think about, like, how do Black community members feel with all these tensions. And I think that, you know, when we were doing, like, Black Heroes of Chinatown, we really wanted to center how our, like, Black community members feel and, like, making sure that they're safe and protected, and kind of adding that narrative to it. But I mean, I think that ultimately the project that we're doing is, like, a project of dismantling white supremacy. And we very much use, like, Consuela's framework. Consuela is our lead, you know, racial justice organizer, strategist. I always say, like, she's the brains and I'm the brawn. So she really is, like, the, you know, the genius behind all of it. But she teaches, like, these unlearning anti-Blackness classes with, like, her framework of, like, white supremacy is based on anti-Blackness, xenophobia, and capitalism. And so when we do Black and Asian relations, it's very strategic, because communities of color are basically pit against each other by white supremacy, so that no one can really get that much. We see that in the high school campaign, where Chinatown wanted a high school, and the Chicago Public Schools was basically saying, you can maybe get a high school, but you would be taking away from the Black community. That would be, like, your only option, right? And then, so this is an instance where, like, no one really wins, or if people do win, it's not to the full extent of what people need and deserve. And it's specifically pitting Black and Asian communities against each other. And so I think that, you know, when we try to bridge these things, like, we're trying to say, like, no, we can ask together as communities of color, living together, like, working together, we all have the same needs, and we can ask for more, and we can ask for all of our needs together. And I think that, like, working across these communities, it's, like, very strategic to work together to build a stronger united front so that we can ask for more things.
Thanks, Angela. I think just hearing those other perspectives of how people feel being in the area, you know, I think it is very empowering. And my hope is we actually all realize, like, that we can get more if we come together. So that's always the goal. So you talked a little bit about the kind of unlearning anti-Blackness in communities, and you have other programs as well. People Matter really just encompasses so many different aspects that are really critical in bettering people's lives. And so I was wondering if, Consuela, if you want to talk about these other programs.
Definitely. So a lot of our programs is through, like, an anti-racism lens that we try to put and implement into it. So we have our community language program, which focuses on, like, people learning, like, English, but also people who are interested in learning Cantonese. So we have, like, one class for heritage speakers, connecting people to their heritage as well as their history as well as language. And then we also have our other portion is, like, Cantonese 101, which is connecting community members of color. And it's, like, everyone of color is allowed in. We try to make sure it's POC friendly, of course. But, yeah, just making sure people are able to learn Cantonese 101 and speak Cantonese. I think that one thing I want to highlight, the importance of it, is that one of the biggest things when we talk to community members about why weren't they not interacting with people outside their race or interacting with Black folks specifically, or even brown folks specifically. And the most thing that people said was language barrier. Even Black folks said language barrier. Latinx folks were saying language barrier. So what we wanted to do is create a class or courses where people can be able to bridge those gaps and interact with each other. And so part of that is, like, a dual immersion version of it as well, where the Cantonese speakers or Cantonese learners are coming together with people who are English learners, and they're teaching each other bits and pieces of the language and communicating with one another and building up that relationship. And I think one of the joyous moments that I have remembered is, like, during a graduation, you have someone, one of our students, which is, like, a bright, bubbly, like, mother, who is learning English, she sees one of the Black folks in the community that was in part of her class. She's like, yeah, you helped me speak better English. And then the Black person responds to her and says, yes, like, you helped me with my Cantonese. Thank you so much. So I think that that was one of the moments of using this anti-racism lens, like, learning from one another, building that community. Another thing I would point to is our Garden Fellows program, which is teaching majority kids of color about environmental injustice in their communities and doing it, again, in the anti-racism lens, right? So we have majority Black and Chinese kids come together and have these conversations around how environmental injustice impacts their communities about why it's important to be good stewards of land. Why is it good to take care of one another? Who is your community? Why is it important to build community across racial lines? And so we have kids between 11 and 18 having these deep conversations, really trying to bridge those gaps of people. In Chicago, we're extremely segregated. So your neighbor, like right across the street, could be a whole different community, but it's so racially segregated that you just, people just don't really interact, even though that may be 10 feet down the street. And so one of the ways we try to do this is making sure these kids that we're bringing in and we're teaching are talking to people, talking to one another, bridging the cultural gaps and really trying to learn from one another and dismantling racial stereotypes that they have both for like Chinese people or Asian Americans, as well as for dismantling those stereotypes that people have for like Black Americans or Black people.
I'll just add one more, which is like working with seniors. You know, actually, in the 60s, Chicago built a lot of, you know, public housing projects that were majority low-income and Black, and a lot around the Chinatown area. So like in the 60s, the population of Black folks increased by 300-400% over that decade. And so since the 60s, you've had a lot of Black and Chinese people living in proximity, but always like segregated, like Consuela mentioned. But now we have like one of the Section 8 buildings in Chinatown is, you know, it used to be all Black and now it's like 70% Chinese seniors. And so, you know, a lot of the people, you know, they live together, but there's a language barrier, there's a cultural barrier, there's like tensions even within the like housing community and the apartment complex. And so like, you know, we were invited to come in to basically like ease those racial tensions. And then we found out there were a lot of like housing conditions that like everyone had troubles with. And so we were doing more like tenant organizing, and we were able to like establish a sort of like temporary democratically elected council of both Black and Chinese residents to work together to advocate for better housing conditions. So there's like work like that as well that is very much issue area based, but also you need to bridge those racial tensions in order to even get to the issue.
I know that, Consuela, you teach the anti-Blackness program. This is something I would love to see happen at OACC. For people who would be unable to attend this program, I was hoping you could talk a little bit about like kind of the layout of it and like some things you've learned from it that you found to be really useful to people to help them kind of think about this anti-Blackness mentality that that is often present in our society.
Yeah, definitely. So we switched it to calling Unlearning Anti-Blackness. But yeah, I can just go over a little bit about the framework of what I use. So a lot of this is due to the readings I had and also a lot of critical thinking as well. And I did a lot of like theory building on like what I feel would be the best way into dismantling racism or dismantling the system that we have at first and that we have in society. So I would just go over some of the principles or some of the steps that I feel are the best things to take when someone is tackling their own internalized anti-Blackness, as well as tackling their own internalized racism. Step one, admitting to a problem. We live in the white supremacist system, so no one can escape it. So many times I run into folks that don't admit that we have a problem. We have a race problem in the United States. So like we have race problem globally. And admitting that people are affected by systematic oppression, admitting the historical traumas that people face. Our job is to unlearn it and become less racist and less problematic within ourselves, as well as so that our neighbors and our community can experience better instances of ourselves, right? And so step two would be like coming to terms with your own personal fall on the racial hierarchy and your own racial identity. Coming to terms with where you fall on the racial hierarchy is super important. I think someone had brought up a conversation with me and Angela maybe some months ago, and they said they don't believe in comparative suffering, but it's not comparative suffering if we're talking about hierarchical things. Some people have it better, some people have it worse, and some people, you know, have it worse than the worst. So I think that just acknowledging that as well and building that up too. And then thirdly, building your sense of self is so important. And I say that because it's good to connect your own race, your own cultural heritage, and your background. And I think that this is important to like take that step in connecting to unlearning racism, but also unlearning anti-Blackness, because sometimes what I see is folks will stay in the step of like identity step, where understanding where they fall on the racial hierarchy, and they just leave it at that, but they don't go to the own, finding their own connectedness within their own community and finding their own connectedness and how they show up in the world and being very secure in that identity. Even with that, I will also warn against taking too much of like a maybe a narcissistic view of it too. So sometimes what I see when people are like in that third principle or third step of like unlearning racism or unlearning anti-Blackness and like connectedness with their own race and culture, they become supremacist in that aspect, being like, my culture is the best, my history is the best. And that's not what I'm saying come out with. Come out with a security, being secure in who you are and your cultural background. And I would say number four would be like, learn other people's histories, learn other people's cultural and historical oppressions. And I think that goes into that too. Learn some other people's histories and stuff like that so that you can be able to empathize with folks and really understand what you're talking about, especially if you either start doing work with teaching other people to unlearn their racism and unlearn their anti-Blackness, but also to also like have people to also for your own personal understanding. And I would say also build and reconcile relationships with those who have been impacted by your racism or your anti-Blackness. With that said, it's like sometimes we hurt people unintentionally, right? Sometimes we say things that we don't mean, and that's within racism and outside of racism, depending on other folks who may have marginalized identities. With that said, we have to remedy and try to reconcile and provide space for healing for those that we have impacted intentionally, unintentionally, consciously, and unconsciously, subconsciously with our racism. And then lastly, I would say seeing people of a different race as extension of yourself. So getting to that place where it doesn't matter if that person is a different race or a different cultural background, that you also see them as extension of your personal self, that you see them as people who deserve liberty, life, and justice, and you're able to recognize them as whole entire people and not just individuals that you see or the others or someone, more people to have sympathy with, that you're truly empathizing with these folks and these human beings. So that's what framework I teach from the most part. And I try to do it in a way where people can feel more connected to the mission that we're teaching at People Matter and the mission that we teach out of, but as well as like try to have like some type of like steps to take. Of course, like these steps can be taken out of order. They're not like written in stone, but I do think these are things that should be taken and steps that should be taken to move forward into developing your own personal theory of change, but also your own sense of unlearning and your own journey of unlearning your own internalized racism and anti-Blackness.
Yeah, so I just want to add something, just because I hear it like very often, is when Consuelo talks in workshops or classes to folks, to East Asians most of the time, about acknowledging the racial hierarchy, or that like East Asians, I use the term yellow, are higher on the racial hierarchy. I think a lot of people get very offensive and they say like, oh, but we go through things, you know, there's a lot of anti-Asian sentiment, anti-Chinese sentiment. There's a model minority myth that says that we don't go through things. And while that is true, I think that it's hard for people to hold space for both that, as well as being higher on the racial hierarchy and benefiting from white supremacy due to being lighter, and also like the historical relationship between, you know, like yellow people and white people being like more privileged, in a more privileged position. And even like the stereotypes that come to, you know, like East Asians and Southeast Asians to some extent is like, it's kind of like more positive in a sense, and maybe like you're overly smart or, you know, you have Confucian wisdom, but it's not the same as like with Black folks, where those stereotypes are more like animalistic, dehuman, like unhuman. And I think that like coming to that basically, like Katsuo was saying, like that acknowledgement of like racial hierarchy and of like the problems here is something that a lot of people have a hard time doing. So I just want to emphasize, it's not saying that we don't, you know, acknowledge our own specific issues and our own oppressions, you know, lack of language access, you know, like other issues, but it also means like holding space for both. And I also think that the way that Consuelo teaches it, she doesn't like call people out. She like really like meets people where they are. And, you know, like a lot of our students are, you know, Chinese immigrant mothers, and like she'll take a different approach to that of talking about police violence than to someone who is very, you know, fluent in like Black Lives Matter and, you know, all these kind of movements. But it's very much like a different approach. And we still get a lot of parents, like a lot of our like immigrant mothers are a huge part of our base, and, you know, come like come out and, you know, like talk about race issues with us.
Oftentimes it is in a smaller group setting. When we do workshops, it's in a larger group setting. So our workshops are more like activity driven and healing based. Usually we have both Black and Asian groups come together, or even if it is just Asian groups that are coming together, we try to focus on healing and asking people to be honest and ask the hard questions that they've been thinking about, specifically when it comes to race.
Thanks for sharing that. And I like that point of that you made, Angela, of like the, it's like, yes, and also this, right? Like there's, you have to hold space for everybody's personal, like where they're coming from. I also really, I thought the language programs that you offer, where it's not just English learning, but also Cantonese learning, was so smart, because it just, then it like kind of values everyone, you know, it's not just this emphasis of like learning English, but then like really people literally coming together through language to find a common ground. And that is always, you know, I have a Filipino artist collective, and sometimes we've talked about how, you know, like I don't speak Tagalog, I'm Filipina, but other people in the group do. And, you know, when we talk in the US, it's like we're using the oppressor's language, you know, this like English language, which is has words that are like created to uphold white supremacy. So I'm curious where you feel like your organization People Matter, where it's been like really successful, and I would love to hear about that.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like our organization has been really successful in pushing our own Chinatown to have these conversations. When we first started, people did not want to have these conversations. They told us like, you guys are too political. But now we're causing our Chinatown to have these deep conversations around race, as well as outside communities, right? To have these deep conversations about race within our local Black communities, and as well as within our local brown communities, to have these conversations about race and how they show up. And I think that what has also happened is that we started to get more organizers and more nonprofit folks coming in to be like, how can we dismantle it in our nonprofits, in our industries? And I think that's something that we have been doing really good with. And I think that another thing I would say is building leadership. We build leadership with a lot of our community members, a lot of the people in our schools that we work with. We build leaders with a lot of our volunteers. And so we try to build leaders, because one thing we want to do is teach people how to fight for themselves too. And we want to give them empowerment to fight for themselves and to take ownership of their life and to have self-determination and to figure out what do they need and what do their community need. And we want to give them a voice to do that and fight for them when they can't, but also give them encouragement to fight for themselves as well. So I think that we have been doing a good job with that. We've been around for only like 2 years basically, and we've been trying to revolutionize our own Chinatown as well as surrounding communities.
Yeah, I think that we are really setting an example of what solidarity can look like. And I would say that I think that like Black and Asian or Black and Yellow solidarity, even though it does have, you know, historical presence, and it is a much stronger background in Oakland than it is in Chicago, actually, but I do think that it's very much not visible in the mainstream. And it's not something that I think many Black folks feel. It's not like something that people feel like, oh yes, we, our communities have a history of solidarity. Like I feel safe behind you. I don't think that is very present at all. And I think that historically, even though there have been movements, don't think that the solidarity has reached its full potential, like at all, and is still so much work to be done, that it almost feels like we're at the very beginning. I do think that this is sort of like a pioneer of solidarity work and what it could look like. A lot of folks that I hear mention like Grace Lee Boggs and Yuri Kochiyama. And of course, like while they have done like amazing, amazing things, I think that they as individuals were very much committed to Black liberation. But in terms of a whole entire community, like schools, churches, like a community coming together and saying we are in solidarity with our Black and brown community members, like I think that's a much different endeavor, is to, you know, like galvanize leadership among like a community rather than to, as an individual, wholeheartedly commit to like, you know, the liberation of everyone. I think that like that's something that has you know, has not really been done in many instances. Of course it has been done, but I think that that's something that I think we're really doing a good job, doing the steps right, like building at the speed of trust, just doing it, you know?
2 years, your organization is 2 years old. That is exciting, because I mean, 10 years from now, to see what will come of it is really, that's great. I just can't wait to see what that looks like. It gives me hope for the future. I am curious, for people who often feel disempowered, do you have ideas of like how to inspire the people to become change makers, you know, active individuals to create change in their own community? I'd love to hear any tips you might have about that.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. For those who may be like a little nervous of stepping up, I would say find the power within yourself. Courage is needed in this line of work. And sometimes you may surprise yourself. And I think that with a little bit of courage and a little bit of power, empowerment, and a little bit of confidence can go a long way in dismantling a lot of these systems. Sometimes it takes one person just to speak up to have a domino effect and have other people speak up. And I think that sometimes it's courage. And don't get me wrong, sometimes I get a little nervous speaking up about stuff because sometimes I'm the only Black person in the room and I'm like, oh, am I going to be that person? But I think that it's nothing wrong with being that person. And I think that finding the power that's within yourself and having confidence in yourself and your ability, and even knowing what you know and what you don't know. Like, you can be like, I'm not sure about this. I don't know too much about this. And educate yourself on that too. Build your personal and internal power, and also educate yourself on things that, you know, that you wish you would have, what was taught, and you wish that you could teach others too.
Yeah, I would say it's definitely a mix of personal agency and will and desire for community. I think also finding a good community to do it with is so important. I think that with an individualist world, oftentimes we put a lot of burden on individuals. And even though free will is definitely like, I believe in like individual power, sometimes like when something goes wrong, people talk about self-care, but there's also community care where sometimes like individuals can't do it alone and community members need to step up to like support. I think that just like the love for community and like building community and like being able to make those connections, like genuine connections, is like, it's like a really big inspirational point. And you know, maybe that reminds me of like the kids, you know, like I get a lot of energy from like working with our youth. So I think that because then it's like you really have someone that you need to be responsible for and that like you need to like protect and like take care of. So I just feel finding that sense of community, whether it's for elders, whether it's with youth, but like really connecting to those folks in your community is like really important.
Thank you for sharing like how you get inspired to like keep going, you know. And I am also curious for Consuela, like what do you find to like help keep you engaged in the work that you do?
I think that what keeps me engaged is, this may sound like corny, but what keeps me engaged more is like, you know, like I guess like seeing people like smiles and seeing people like actually start thinking about how to show up in the world, I guess, in a sense, or how they show up in the world currently, and like to see like people's minds change. And I think that sometimes it can be so hard because sometimes it'd be like we're like hitting a brick wall and it just seems like folks are not getting it, and sometimes it just can feel so difficult. But then sometimes when you get that moment where that one person's like, I get it, and you're like, you get it, and they're like, yes, I get it now, you know, and it just washes over you like, okay, this is the reason why I'm doing the work. I'm doing it to change minds, and changing minds are not easy, right? If it was easy, then we'd all be on the same accord all the time. Sometimes when we work with our like Chinese immigrant mothers, they like sometimes can say things that are anti-Black, but then sometimes through our conversations that I'm having with them, through the conversations me and Angela are having with them too, they like change their opinion. They're like, no, Black lives do matter. And like something they wouldn't have said a year ago, something they don't even say in front of me. And then now today on XYZ day, they're saying Black lives matter and they get it, you know? And then they tell other people about it, and they explain to people in Mandarin or Cantonese or Taiwanese about like what they learned. And it's like, yes, you're becoming a leader. So I think that's something that really touches my heart when it comes to doing this work, and that keeps me going and keeps me excited and connected to why it's so important, so very, very important to do this work.
Yeah, I mean, that's like real change that you're seeing. It's exciting. That's awesome. But in Chinatown, we have had more like police surveillance, you know, as requested by the Oakland China, like different chambers and stuff. And a lot of business owners feel safer and stuff like that. And obviously it's very problematic, the relationship with the police. And so how have you been kind of addressing this topic in your own area or around police surveillance or police involvement in the Chinatown community?
One thing that we've been doing is, of course, talking about the root issues. Our alderman, I think, is pretty proactive in just like when having community meetings, bringing together the voices that, you know, like the businesses and the people who do want more police, but also like bringing us in so that we can talk about the root issues and bringing the mental health orgs in. So we do have a really strong advocate in our alderman. But I also think that in turn, there have been way more shootings that are highly visibilized than like ever before in our Chinatown. In one of those public safety meetings, it was like December 2021, it was like near Christmas, and there was another shooting. There was a huge community public safety meeting. And what we tried to do was bring in the Black organizations who work on the South Side with us, who are really strong in their community, to just be at the table. And also like having those like longtime relationships with them, prepping them like, hey, these are the different community orgs. This is where they stand, you know, like this is how the landscape is going to be when you come in here, and just like giving them a seat at that table. When teaches like the English class in the community language program, we will talk about police surveillance, and we will talk about what are alternatives to the police. But you know, the way we would probably say it is not tackle your anti-Blackness. It would be more like, oh, the police are like really busy, and this may take their time away. You know, you don't always want to call them when you see a Black person for these other reasons that are also like important reasons. And just like breaking down, even when there is more police, that doesn't always solve crime, because like Consuela has a workshop about like why more police doesn't solve crime, because, you know, in a lot of like Black communities, there are more police, and that doesn't really do much to the crime if not exacerbating it. So, you know, workshop, community meetings, just like one-on-one conversations. And, you know, just really trying to like be that alternative. And then of course, like the Garden Program is a violence prevention program. So we're trying to like have more data around that to show that like, hey, violence prevention programs that work with Black kids are like effective, and they're effective like not within 5 years, 10 years, like they can be effective within like 1 year or 2 years if you really invest.
Thanks, Angela. Consuela, is there anything you wanted to add?
Definitely. Yeah, Angela touched on my workshop. I was going to talk about the workshop, like why more police don't solve crime. And like, I just basically go over sometimes adding more police does not solve crime. And then another ways that we talk about it too is like sometimes we, even in English classes or maybe even with individuals, we give alternatives to calling the police as well. Maybe you can call us if something's happening. Like call someone for our organization. We can show up if it's just like something that has to do with someone like loitering or like someone like, you know, not really doing anything wrong. They're just like, just there, you know? Or if it's like, you can call us if you feel like, you know, something is happening and stuff like that. You know, like just leaving our lines open and instead of like involving the police directly, right? Because sometimes some things can just be talked about individually, right? Some things can be like, hey, excuse me, can you get off my porch? Or some of this can be like, you know, I would appreciate if you wouldn't, blah, blah, et cetera. Like some of this is like the conversational things. And I think that sometimes people are really scared to have a confrontation. And I think that, and also this assumption that Black people are confrontational, or like people who are perceived to do more crime or confrontational. If people can tackle that and just really just talk to people, because I'm pretty sure like you ask people and they will just definitely answer honestly and be like, okay, or most people are reasonable people, I would say. So they would just leave. And so that's other ways that we try to tackle people consistently calling the police or people who are consistently trying to make Chinatown, our Chinatown specifically in Chicago, a police neighborhood. It is definitely a police neighborhood. Like the police is down the street from us. They're very much involved. We have a lot of surveillance happening in Chinatown. But we're trying to start these conversations around, do they really help? Like, yeah, we know who did it because we have a camera, but it doesn't really stop the crime from happening. So what can we do to stop this crime?
Okay, cool. No, thank you for kind of relaying what you do and these like steps into these conversations. So it's really helpful to me. And I really enjoyed talking with you two, and it was really inspiring. And so I really appreciate the time you took to have this dialogue.
This podcast was produced with the support of the Ginkgo Fund, the Asian Pacific Fund, and the Awesome Foundation. Want to suggest future guests? Email us at programs@oacc.cc.